joining us today is Mark Thornton. He is, of course, a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, and the author of The Economics of Prohibition. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Redmond. It's great to be back on Better Red Than Dead.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can check us out. Thanks for the mention of the show name there, Mark. And you can check us out, of course. Everybody should be signing up at Stitcher and iTunes for the Better Red Than Dead show. Now, Mark, we're here to discuss what seems to me to be almost totalitarian, I don't know, fascism, totalitarian socialism being promoted, it would seem to me, in the pages of the Financial Times by a guy named Martin Wolf, who has written a piece called Wipe Out Rentiers with Cheap Money. Now, why don't we go into this piece or dig into this thing?
Well, it's absolutely stunning. It's absolutely barbaric. I never would have thought I would see such a blatant, you know, almost like genocidal type editorial where Wolf comes out against the rentier, which Keynes famously named in his passage called the euthanasia of the rentier.
Mm-hmm,
and the,
yes.
The rentier in Keynes's day was the landowning aristocracy who had all this, you know, aristocratic monarchical land and government bonds, and so they were living off, you know, the interest of all that, and they were going untouched in terms of taxes. You know, so you can sort of have a little sympathy for that. But in today's context, the idea of using cheap money is really he's going after the regular people of society who save money, who buy insurance, and who, you know, have pensions and retirement accounts. And he's saying use the printing press at the Federal Reserve or central banks everywhere to siphon off wealth from these ordinary regular people classes in order that the money goes to Wall Street, big banks, large corporations, hedge funds, and all of that. So, I mean, it's just, it was really, truly unbelievable. It's something that I almost don't recommend people to read. It's so awful.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's amazing. It's pretty amazing what's going on in England. I think there's another article that I read in the Telegraph entitled David Cameron, Taxes Will Rise Unless We Can Raid Bank Accounts. David Cameron claims he will have to put up taxes unless tax officials are given draconian powers to raid people's bank accounts. Apparently, they want to pull strip taxes directly from people's bank accounts. It's this is kind of stunning to me what's going on right now. Like, it seems, I mean, they were claiming somehow that there was this austerity going on within Britain and in, you know, I mean, obviously they're spending to continue to go up. So I don't know what kind of austerity it is, but it just seems to me that, and you also have these other sort of crazy proposals that sound like sort of green, almost greenbacker type proposals coming out of England as well, where they're saying we just need to, you know, we should stop fractional reserve banking by private banks, but we should allow the central bank to just print as much money as it possibly can. You know, there's we can stop saying these things like, oh, you know, there's not enough money to pay for X, Y, or Z when we can just print it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the United States and Great Britain, but governments all over the world seem to have gotten incredibly arrogant. You know, with the central banks and the governments running up all these debts and the central banks trying to, you know, monetize that debt, and they've caused this economic crisis. They've caused this economic malaise throughout the global economy. And then they're just arrogant about causing these things and expecting, you know, taxpayers and citizens who are doing all the work, that are doing all the heavy lifting in society, they're expecting those people to pay for their mistakes and their mismanagement of government. And, you know, so it's higher taxes, it's more cheap money to monetize the government debt, you know, taxing people's bank accounts. And then, of course, the bail-ins that have been set up as role models in the U.S. and in the U.K., but, you know, were also used in Cyprus and will probably be used in other countries, the European countries and the Japanese and Chinese banks, they could all be subject to bail-ins, which means if the banks fail, and many of these banks around the world are in really bad shape and are only being kept afloat by this free money from the central banks, you know, if those banks go under, it's the depositors that are going to lose money from their accounts. So that's the bail-in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in order to protect to a certain degree stockholders and bondholders and the Treasury, they're going to basically be reneging on promises of deposit insurance and simply wiping out, or at least taking a heavy, what's called haircut, you know, from the depositor. So the arrogance amongst governments, political leadership, certainly President Obama is a good example of that as well, and central bankers. I mean, it's incredible the arrogance and the nonchalant attitudes that they're taking when in reality the system is incredibly vulnerable. As it stands from, you know, the time of the beginning of the economic crisis to now, basically governments have dramatically increased their national debt and they've increased the balance sheet on their central banks. And that's all fuel for a fire of gigantic proportions or maybe something worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't even get where this guy's getting his data from in the idea. So he's saying things like, I guess he's pushing for ultra low interest rates continuing, right? So he's saying in the case of pension funds, reduced long-term yields are particularly unwelcome because they both lower returns and raise the present value of future liabilities. Many life insurers might be forced out of business if these rates persist. This is a crisis on a long fuse. And then he says this policy, however unpopular with some, is better than the available alternatives. Now, but I don't understand where he thinks all these savers are, all these rentiers are sitting on all this money. You know, I just pulled up Charles Schwab. If you go to schwab.com, you can find a page that was written in 2013 called Baby Boomer Reality Check. In 2013, Retirement Confidence Survey, they conducted a survey with workers age 55 and older, and they said the following about their retirement savings. 60% had less than $100,000 in savings, 43% had saved less than $25,000, and 36% had saved less than $10,000 towards their savings. And this is workers age 55 and older. Now, the people who had, you know, potentially been working the longest in the market and should, you know, theoretically have the most savings. Where is he getting this idea that there's all these people sitting out there on all sorts of money? And apparently he's not only that, he's saying that they're apparently, it says, he says as well, at present, the world's high propensity to save. Now maybe all the, you know, maybe all the, you know, maybe all the sort of volatility created by the central banks in the markets maybe causing people to want to save is not matched by a desire to invest. Like again, you know, all the central bank inflation, intervention in the markets, boom and bust cycles, all created by intervention. It's not surprising that people would maybe be shy away from putting their money into the markets. Now, I don't even think that's happening because, you know, you look at, you know, people, they can't earn any return on anything unless they put it into the market. So where do you think he's getting these ideas about this?
Well, Redmond, there's really two sides of the page. And on the front side of the page, you have the most responsible and productive people in the economy. These are people who form households, who, you know, are paying down on a house and improving a house. They're getting insurance for their house and their car and their health and, you know, their business and so on. And then they have pensions or they have retirement accounts. And these are the people that are hurt by cheap money and low interest rates. It's harder to get a return. So insurance companies have their back against the wall. Pensions have their back against the wall. Households are having a very difficult time and declining real incomes. And so they're all getting hurt and they're being forced into more riskier investments. It's either, mm-hmm. you know, park your money and lose purchasing power over time due to inflation and taxes, or put it into the stock market and junk bonds to get a return but face the possible large capital losses. So those are all the people on the front of the page that are being hurt by cheap money and low interest rates. And on the back side are all these people who have been discouraged from savings due to low interest rates, particularly if you take into account inflation and taxes, you're actually losing money from savings. And so these are all people who have been lured into borrowing lots of money. You know, they're not paying down a mortgage or they don't have a mortgage. They don't have much disposable income because they're paying high interest charges on all of the debt. And so they're underinsured. They don't have any retirement. They're not qualifying for a pension. And so all those people on the backside, they've been adversely affected by this cheap money, low interest rate regime. And they've been just basically their ability to stabilize their situation in the economy has been greatly undermined by those low interest rates, which has discouraged savings and encouraged borrowing. And so their backs are really up against the wall.
Well, what's hilarious too is when you keep going with this guy's article, I mean, these people just really want it. You know, they want it every way, right? They want the government to have more control. But in his final, piece, he says, well, you know, what is needed instead are genuinely risk-taking investors. What are you talking about? You know, for the last 5 years, you know, all we've been hearing about is about these terrible investment people, you know, who sort of risked all this money and lost it all on these terrible investments, you know, like subprime mortgages and all these sorts of things, and probably destroyed the savings of, you know, probably tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. We've been hearing nonstop, and of course, then all these people are being bailed out. But of course, it's the moral hazard created by people like this Martin Wolf guy. It was the moral hazard created by the Fed bailing people out by, you know, deposit insurance and these sorts of things, which created all these problems, which created these people who are supposedly taking too many risks. And now he's saying, well, no, we need more risk-taking investors in their, and then he says, in their absence, governments need to use their balance sheets to build productive assets. I mean, yeah. What does that even mean? It seems to me that the Financial Times, and I could look into the history of it, but it seems to me that he just is calling for essentially, you know, like full on sort of national socialism or fascism of some sort when applied to the economy.
Well, he comes out clear as day here as a Keynesian, mm-hmm. because his preferred solution is large public works projects around the world financed by deficits, but he doesn't think governments are willing to expand any more than they already have. And so that's why you get this secondary Keynesian policy of monetary so-called stimulation. You know, and when I first heard of this guy, it was about 2008, a good friend of mine, a prominent architect, went to a professional conference in Chicago at which Mr. Wolf was speaking. And during his speech, he said, the best research on real estate economics is being done in Auburn, Alabama. And this floored my friend because he went to Auburn. He's a big Auburn University alumni, and he was just shocked. And so he came running up to me at this Auburn event, and he told me this story. And so I thought, well, that's great. I'm really surprised that Martin Wolf is visiting Mises.org. But okay. Of course, we had been writing about the housing bubble, and the only other publications that were really writing about the housing bubble before it burst prominently was The Economist magazine, but of course that's the competitor to the Financial Times, so he didn't want to say that. So he mentioned us. And but he's now, you know, just an outright horrendous Keynesian that with no remorse, no lament, just stick it to the average Joe, basically, and benefit the 1%. I mean, it was just absolutely terrible. And of course, this cheap money policy has not worked. It certainly hasn't worked in Japan, who's been using it for 25 years.
Yeah.
And they're in much worse shape now, despite, you know, massive public works, 0% interest rate, quantitative easing, Abenomics, and nothing is going right over in Japan. And so there's nothing that, you know, if you want to look at the evidence, you know, obviously these people are unwilling to look at Austrian theory, which explains all this.
Yeah, yeah.
But looking at the evidence, they should be questioning the viability of their policies because they simply have not worked. Japan has covered all of their islands with concrete of one form or another with some public works program, and their national debt is now 214% of their gross domestic product, and they're still mired in that stagnating economy, and there's no sign that they're going to be able to fix themselves going down the path that they're actually going down right now.
Yeah, well, it's a funny kind of situation, right? Because at the same time that we're seeing these problems, say in Japan and whatnot, and you know, problems around the world with various economies, you know, I was talking to somebody who works for like a taxpayers, you know, federation here in Toronto. You know, that sort of, you know, aims to have lower taxes and these sorts of things. And we were discussing the fact that we have this election on here in Toronto or in here in Ontario. And she was saying, you know, this guy was coming in and he's working in Toronto. You know, he's working in Toronto, trying to talk to people here in the city about, you know, the problems with the debt, you know, because Ontario has more debt than California, but has one population of California, which is,
wow.
Yeah, which is hilarious. We actually have, if you go back, published on Friday on the Mises Canada website, we actually have an article not on the blog, but if you go to the daily section, we have a piece all about the Ontario pension plans. Apparently now the Ontario government wants to, have its own Ontario pension plan beyond the Canadian pension plan. And if you look at this, in terms of bonded debt, California has $144 billion of bonded debt, and Ontario has $267 billion of bonded debt, which is 40% of the GDP of Ontario, $20,000 per capita, 9.2% of revenue, of all government revenue is spent on interest on debt here in Ontario. This was actually 2011, 2012. Now,
wow.
Yeah, I know it's pretty
That's
stunning.
Scary.
Yeah, I know it's funny, but at the same time, you know, we're here in Toronto, which is essentially it's sort of like the New York City of Canada. You know, it's a center of finance and that sort of thing. And because of the way the Cantillon effect works, right? You know, we're sort of at the center of it. You know, we get the money first. You know, so the house prices continue to go up. You know, new restaurants are opening. Everything seems to be going great. You know what I mean? Like, it's this kind of weird disconnect where, you know, we're just going deeper, deeper into debt. Now, of course, what people don't seem to realize is that, of course, once you get outside of the city, you see the negative effects of this financialization of the market. So if you look at our, manufacturing sector, of course, you know, like in Southern Ontario, it's sort of a rust belt, right? You know, we've got factories closing. Our electricity rates are going up like crazy because of our crazy Green Energy Act. So, you know, businesses are leaving. We just keep throwing taxes on to pay for all this spending that we're doing. So I think Unilever just closed up shop in Ontario. So it's this weird kind of disconnect when you live in the city where it's the center of, you know, so it's hard to say to people, like, it's an interesting thing to try to tell people, well, look, we're sort of on the road to ruin. They're like, but look around us. Everything's going great.
Yeah, it's not funny. It's scary and sad. But you're right. You know, New York City and Washington D.C. down here, everything's going great, and they're popping the champagne bottles and the champagne corks, and you know, everything is back to the bubble times, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Incomes in New York City and Washington, D.C. are zooming higher. Real estate prices are zooming higher. Their specialty markets, particularly New York, are doing extremely well when you compare that to what's going on, you know, outside of New York City and outside of the major banking centers. Things are not so good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we both have, of course, the energy industries in Canada and the U.S., and those have been doing very well, particularly the high-cost, you know, oil shales and sands and things of that nature. Those are high-cost sources, and, you know, if energy prices were to be zapped, which typically happens in a recession, you know, as we go through the bubble, resources get tighter, energy prices spike. But once the constraint hits, the economy goes into recession, and those energy prices come right back down to normal. And of course, energy prices have been high for a long time. And if once you take out those extra revenues, which are sort of free revenues for the productive side of the economy, and you discount those sectors and those provinces and states, you see economies where there's really very few states and provinces that are growing outside of the banking sector.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And I think that what happens too, and I was discussing this with a real estate agent yesterday, you know, because we were discussing the markets and whatnot. Because, I mean, even him, you know, he's been a real estate agent, you know, probably since the early 2000s or something. So he's sort of been through this entire bubble, you know, this entire housing situation. Even he's sort of like, you know, thinking like, this is a bit odd, you know, like, you know, this isn't necessarily a good thing. And the thing is that it takes time for the effects really to be felt from this, right? So 10 years ago, you know, you might be able to rent, and the long-term effect of all of this, you know, radical money printing and zero interest rates, you know, although they're printing all this money, which, you know, theoretically, hey, everybody should be doing better. It, you know, it really does destroy people's quality of life over time. So, you know, if somebody, say, bought their house in the 1970s, like, let's say I, you know, the house I rented in 2003, let's say in this neighborhood, you know, maybe it was a two-bedroom with a basement, it probably went for about $1,200, you know, a month, something like that. Now today in 2014, you know, if you're somebody who then bought a house in this neighborhood, and you're looking to rent it, you may have paid $700,000, $800,000 for that house. So to make a return on your investment, all of a sudden you've got to charge, you know, $2,500, $2,800 a month just to make the return on your investment on a rental property, which is going to negatively impact, that person who's going to be renting. It's going to take away from their spending ability, which is, in the end, it's really going to suck. You know, when they talk about, you know, let's say quote unquote aggregate spending or these sorts of things, the ability of people to actually buy things and engage in economic transactions is really going to be reduced because a far larger percentage of their income, disposable income, is just going to go to housing or something like that.
Yeah, it's someone's going to pull the sheet out from underneath a lot of people, and all of those arrangements, those mortgages, those investment plans, those rental plans are, you know, going to be shot, and people are going to lose money. And, you know, when you, more to your basic point, Redmond, was, you know, it took economists 150 to 200 years to figure out and to transmit to other people the idea that an economy only needs a certain amount of money,
mm-hmm.
and that adding more money doesn't improve things. It actually makes it slightly worse.
Yeah.
And so we went from a situation where the kings and princes and queens were, you know, using various inflationary programs to try to pay for wars and their own, you know, opulence. And economists from Cantillon that you mentioned earlier, the classical economists, you know, the currency school in England, you know, they finally figured out that you want a stable money supply so that the economy can work around that stable money supply, and that it should be based on gold and silver money. And then, of course, we get to the classical gold standard in the late 19th century. And then Mises comes in 1913 with the theory of money and credit, and basically completes the theoretical apparatus that tells us that you want a stable monetary system with gold and silver as the anchor, the measuring stick mm-hmm. of money, and that you want a stable banking system based on property rights, not government regulation.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Now we've gone another 150 years to the point where we've lost that major lesson of economics that was drilled into me as a sophomore in college. Even the Keynesians understood it back then. It was in all the textbooks.
Yeah.
And now we're to the point where it's you get these central bankers together, and it's just one program of money printing after another. There's been a lot of what are called innovations in monetary policy, but they basically all involve printing more money electronically. And in handing that money off to governments or the banks or, you know, whatever it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
But we've completely dropped that essential rule, that essential teaching of economics, that any amount of money is sufficient, and increasing the money supply doesn't help the economy. It actually hurts it a little bit, because you're not producing as much food, clothing, and shelter. You're taking resources and using them to make money, and you don't need that much more money. And so we've lost that piece of knowledge, and
yeah.
We're suffering as a consequence.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I was just talking to Jeffrey Tucker a couple days ago about this, and, you know, 100 years ago in the United States, the money supply was socialized, essentially. Money was socialized in the United States with the creation of the Fed. And now we have a situation where in the entire world, we have a socialized monetary system. And of course, we know what happens when you have socialization of anything is you have stagnation, you have lack of innovation, and all these sorts of things. And I think this is why, you know, things like Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies have started to pop up. Largely, you know, because we've had sort of 100 years now of lack of innovation in money. And, you know, we've got about a minute left. So I don't know if you want to just give me your 2 cents on, you know, where do you see us sort of ending up? Are we going to go back to a classical gold standard at some point, cryptocurrency standard? You know, how are we going to innovate our way out of this?
Well, I mean, I've been expecting innovation in monetary systems around the edges, around the fringes of society. And at first, I thought it would be a commodity good that people would just start circulating as a medium of exchange. And then I thought, well, maybe old junk silver coins would start doing it.
Yeah.
But you know, on the periphery was always this idea of a digital form of cash. And so I see that as a good development. I see that as a sign that the central banks are really screwing things up, and that people are looking desperately for an alternative. And there's 36 competing digital currencies out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully expect that to continue.
Absolutely. So thanks again, Mark, and let's talk soon.
My pleasure, Redmond. See you soon.
Hey, bye.